great to see you. I'm going to let Joe Torres start up. Thank you.
All right, so thanks for coming and helping us out today and celebrating the new mag. I'm going to read, and then folks will come up and read what Mander and I were thinking about putting this event together rather than just have people come and read their own work. Was why don't we ask some of our friends to read some other Boston poets. So we kind of came up with the Boston Area Poets Reads Boston Area Poets theme. And I'll just introduce people. I think most of you know everyone reading today, which is a good thing, so they don't need an introduction except by name. So I'll call them up. As one finishes, I'll just call the next up, and they don't even know when they're reading, so you better listen closely, Carol.
Could you do the order, please?
I will.
Near the end.
I will. You want to be near the end?
Well, because I'm not quite.
Okay. Well, how about we put you right before Garrett at the end?
Okay.
So I'd like to begin, and this is on November 16th, 1964. Garrett, salutations, red wine, and roses. Your communications received and appreciated. I have been both reading and writing something furious. Oh no, what have I said? After I finish this to you, I'm going out for relaxing and booze, too much concentration, etc. I send you only one thing I'm sure of, Measure 4. This is his poem, not the magazine. I've spent weeks working on it. Metric that heretofore has least concerned me does now concern me. Free verse has, for me, dire consequences. If we speak in time, then our things must arrest and retain this time. I have tried, short of counting, to recognize in the ear such measures that, as it were, laboring to bring forth newly born some particular worthy of celebrating by the wise, with the while, sheep, cows, and other kind look in, etc. Image taken from some Flemish master with due thanks, C. Marlowe, Dr. Faustus, as some help, being, as it were, to me, the foreign tongue. Turning, fresh from C. Marlowe, to our own speech idiom, I heard Measure 4. I have a whole notebook full of new things, but I must tinker with the metric before I send them to you or anyone. I may send you one other thing that's sung, subjectively, but of course, the metric of it I have no doubt of. Pound and Williams constantly revised and reformed their line. The earlier, and by comparison, their later things reveal some change in speech rhythms. Listen, but you must keep right on talking, please. Try to make it rhyme. You know, your mind's on vacation and your mouth's working overtime. The above from Mose Allison, jazz singer, pianist. Have you heard of him? He is at present featured at the Jazz Workshop on Boylston Street. Forget what record company he records for, maybe Prestige. Though I enjoyed you and Jack's readings the last time you were here, I wanted to see the printed poems. I didn't ask, though I would still like to read copies of them. The potted plants are thriving. Note, alchemy, a mine of precious ore with poetic possibilities, Nespa. Carlos, my old roommate of 4 or 5 years, back again living with me. Don't let this deter you from coming in and staying over. Plenty of room. Saw Jack briefly about 2 weeks ago. Seemed okay. Love, affectionately, Steve. And I'll finish with Bill Corbett, poem The Well. Let the bucket down. Let what fills it fill it to the lip. What slops over, slop over, and be lost in this draw, and be there when the bucket is let down again. Let the hard earth cellar floor be there. Caroline Harder, the Mummy Brothers, Tommy McArdle, Pippi Rader, the hairless babyman dealing authors. Let the snap purse, leather purse worn on the baker's belt be there. It is and has been since he made change. Careful with his coins for puffy powdered jelly donuts that sparkling leafy afternoon. Let the red Schwinn bike, first bike, be there. Let the red stone spit on one side, tossed high, wet or dry, be there. Butchie Eichhorn, Harry the left-hander, Connie Beans, the dry cellar where beer and soda are stacked in crates, be there, as trapped inside the fear never leaves. Let the names come up, what sign of them remains, faces lost, Ricky Ron, two beside me in a wagon, black Eaton suit and cap, black jig Scotty dog. Let the house in ruins above Brady's Lake. No, it appears a print with moon, a movie still. Let the left step, stop cakewalk, hold its breath that the arrow clear from dark torches made darker, blaze deeper, and torches above the fur-hatted hat of Ethan Allen be there, as he boldly knocks on Fort Ticonderoga's door demanding entrance, as he knocked and the commandment answers in his nightshirt holding a candle up to the handsome steel engraved faces. Draw the bucket up with the image pure and stripped by time, by memory worn down to essence, to witness, mirror smoky blue ropey laurel leaf cigar smoke and cough and swearing bad word song in the stealing Lehigh Valley coal where bedbugs play shimmy round me whole. Grape arbor, lattice makes shadow of sunlight. Penn Lake shallows, crooked wavelets. Vegetable hawkers, tin scoop scale. What are these things and names in me? The strike and pull of a catfish horned and black deep in the dark. The slimy cream catfish underside. Pick and shovel clinks. Miners under Lansford streets. How deep are they? Little Green Riding Hood, let the bucket down. Once to brain or heart's depth. The stream it seeks runs unceasingly. Nothing then was pure as now it comes to light. Comes free from the mess of days. Sudden as the deer. Buck or doe leapt up over the car's hood at Bear Run as we came from the Lake of Stones. If it comes to light, if it is dark there at all, let the bucket down. Amanda Cook.
I'm gonna sit. So I got really sentimental looking through things, trying to figure out what to read today. And I opted for the first reading I went to in Boston, which was a Zoland Books reading of Sam Cornish, who was my professor at Emerson, and Joe Torre. So, isn't that funny? So I wanted to start with a few poems by Sam Cornish. And this book has a lot of bookmarks in it. So I hope I get to the right ones. Why I did not give my seat to that white man in 1932. I am a working woman, an all-day woman. My hands are stones that beat these clothes to white. Sweat burns my hips, churn and thrust my breasts have weaned the self. My feet kept moving long after sunrise, and the moon followed me. My old feet buried within my shoes. My head is a southern tongue. My heart is a Scottsboro boy telling his story. A tale longer than the history this woman has seen before she came back home in the Jim Crow car. Ma. You heard of Ma Rainey. She made the blues sound like a piano moaning. Folks like me. In the unemployment line, with those early morning economic blues at home on my feet, the president said the economy is doing fine. Guess it's just taking its time getting down to folks like me. And then I have Joe Torre, who One thing I've been thinking a lot about this week is working and work songs. With the passing of Pete Seeger, I've been thinking about what it means to write about working and to be working and to be in touch with what it's like to be tired. So Joe's very good for this. Excuse for not visiting friends. Don't be offended because I'm slow to go out. You know me too well for that. On my lap, Celeste Ann cries, won't let me put her down. Julia Gahn stands at my knees, waits for an answer. They hang on my clothes. They follow my every move. There's piles of laundry, bathrooms to clean, dinner. Toys and crumbs rule floors. I can't get any farther than the front porch. I'm afraid I won't make it to your house today. Feelings on the night of December 12th, 2000, as I work a busy waiter shift at the restaurant. What am I doing here? Looking up at the clock, the strength gone from my legs, crow's feet around my eyes, my head and beard gray, bowing, serving, pouring, smiling, clearing, crumbing, more bread, coffee, water, wine. Moonlight climbs a long window, weaves frost crystals. I think of my wife and daughters. I shouldn't complain or be jealous of the moon when my children remember me at home. And surely I'm better off than a campaigning soldier listening for an alarm. I know how long the night is. I know how long the night is. One cannot keep pace with ambition. No sunshine on past wounds. Time runs me down. This night's never like the last. Noisy traffic pulls me along and I get no rest right through dawn. Fish out of water. I took books to work in the garage. Guys began to talk. Friends turned against me. So I broke those ties. Now I read all I want. Who will bring a bucket of water to save a stranded fish? And then I want to finish up with a few poems by Jack Evans from his pressed wafer book, Work. Jack is a Gloucester boy, and Gloucester man, rather. And his writing about work is pretty great. A ride with a dying man. I drove a cab on and off for a number of years. The money wasn't so good, but you could go in when you wanted, and in those days, they paid same day, 50% of the total under the table, and for that night, you had money, you had made it through. I couldn't get along with the dispatcher, so I'd turn off the radio and after each ride head back to the stand to wait for the next one. When he got in, I knew right away he was dying. His face was pale as a toadstool, and the misery was on him like a $2 overcoat. Emphysema, he said. Don't smoke, kid. It'll kill you. His breath was loud and labored. I could feel my own chest tighten up in sympathy. Do me a favor, kid. Open both windows. I'll tip you good. We drove out to the highway, and for a good hour, he had me drive 30 miles an hour in the right-hand lane, cars honking away behind us. Don't worry about those cocksuckers, kid. Just keep driving. I'll tip you good. He had figured the speed at which the wind was from the open windows would enter his lungs and allow him to feel that he could almost breathe. He didn't talk, just leaned back in the seat, taking long, shaking gulps of air, a look of total ecstasy on his face. Finally, he signaled to me to turn off, directing me to his place, a rooming house in Somerville. The meter was up to $38. He gave me four tens and said, keep the change, kid, you did a good job. He limped up the walk, then struggled up the stairs to the landing. Before he opened the door, he paused, took out a Pall Mall and lit it. He looked back at me with an odd smile on his face, then went inside, and I headed back to the stand. The nanny. You have to love the children. God knows they are our only hope. For 30 years I cared for them. When they burped up deathly odors, when I had to wipe away every imaginable liquid and solid from their little bodies, even in the dizzy contagion of the sick room, I never turned my face away from the face of a weeping child. But this boy whose face was clear and bright as the sun made me change my mind. Here, Nanny, he said, holding out his two sweet fists. Pick a hand. How cute he looked then. I chose the right, and he handed me several small objects. At first, I thought they might be tiny buttons, but there was something about them, a kind of vibration that disturbed me. Then he opened the other hand to display a tangled bunch of skinny lines that jumped and twitched like the nerves that were beginning to move beneath my skin. Daddy Longlegs, he said, smiling up at my stricken face as my heart put on its little white shoes and ran from that green park to a quieter place where children are forbidden to enter. I did love the children, but now I care for the sick and aged. There are no surprises, and they so appreciate the touch of a gentle hand. And this last poem is Fiesta. Today they will carry the statue of St. Peter, patron saint of fishermen, through the streets of my town. When he returns and Fiesta is over, he will be covered in money, and the fleet will be blessed. The wrinkled sea will pause from its dumb labor, and from my place of work, I will look across Main Street past the empty space where my grandfather's father had his tailor shop. He was a small Russian Jew with careful hands. I am larger and clumsier and lack his courage. But looking out over the harbor, I see America gleaming like a dangerous but beautiful fish, and I too am caught in the nets, still breathing but unable to remember my real name. Thanks.
Stand and then sit. I'm going to start with, somebody might know this letter. It's a letter from Jack Kerouac to Charles Olson. I was trying to find something else in here, but there's no way I can find it when I need it. So there's a great little poem that Kerouac wrote for Measure that was never published. I shan't be reading that, but I'll read you this. Here is the footnote. Shortly after the closing of Black Mountain College, on September 21st, 1957, Olson relocated with his family to Gloucester, Mass. There he had written Kerouac that he'd been impressed with the prose sketch, Neil and the Three Stooges, in new editions and selections from the prose poem Old Lucian Midnight in Combustion magazine. Olson also had said, spoken highly of Kerouac's writing to Don Allen, claiming, "You as a poet, on the basis of the major hoople swag in Combustion, it's tight form and delicious." Dear Olson, I preened up like a turkey cock when I read your letter. Oh, peace, mother, for the mammothness of the comings and goings of the ladders of life. It's surely mighty poetry. So you too be poet. We sent all my poems, 200 pages, to Ferlinghetti to publish, others now in John Wiener's Pub's Measure, big New York poetry readings being arranged by Big Press, agent Joe Lustig. Unless you feel the renaissance of English poetry should be confined to the humble ones. When I get my typewriter, I write you a proper letter. In writing, give my love to Robert. So what was mentioned was Measure magazine, and there's a great, great article by Rob Dewhurst in the first, Let the Bucket Down. And I just noticed that, I think it's totaled by accident, in the magic one that I have, the very first one, there's a bullet hole of ink there, which I think is really, really great, and I think John meant it to be there, so. The really crazy thing, I'll get to Measure 3. A friend of mine was driving through Western Mass and pulled over to a small little bookstore, and he found John Wiener's personal copy of Measure, and it has his address in New York City in it. But it also has something crazy in it. John really wanted to get Marianne Moore for this edition of Measure, and she was going to give him a poem and didn't. I think it's documented by Seth Stewart in his letters that are coming out. And so she didn't, and this is what John was apt to do, so he didn't get a poem, so he cut out a picture of her and put it in there where I think he thought her poem should be, which is great. So I'll read a couple things from the first one, and then I'll read some from the third, and I'll end with John's poem, a great poem on the Imperatrice. So this is Steve Jonas, Word on Measure. In the beginning, the word, imperfect, half-meaning, half-longing, but for the poem of the fairy, like wings to fly off on. If we measure, we reckon, or fairy dust, what rubs off the word, measure that, the rest, silences being. My little light knows me. Is life a verb, and without measure, and? If the poem is, if anything, becoming, not become, that sounds under glass, ising, hums like a bee. The poem's a very light measure. Error, a dance, yes. Thank you, Dr. Williams. That's spontaneous. Celebration, the noisy brat with brassy bees. makes it. Shit, the intellectual sun is nothing but a complete collected warehouse. It's the consumer poem. What takes and makes it? What is something else? See in. Measure 3 was the city. Measure 1 was magic. And there never was a measure 4. Measure 2, I do not have a copy with me, but it's a great one. It has Creeley and as Kerouac did give him some poems for that one as well, which were Mexico City Blues, which are published. And this is a poem by my friend Garrett Lansing. Explorers. Coursing black savannas, cruising broken cities, the explorer drew perceptive fever charts, slept with foxes, traded furs with wild children. He learned to listen for the crackling of dry thorns, beware the sucking mouths of slime that took so many, and not to swim in haunts of moccasin and copperhead. He was alone in his abandon, and occasional rejoicing gave little mercy to his body as it bled away, until by northern quarries, on a littoral of sea ghosts, he found what he had never known, the companion born to share, the fallow fellow in the ardors of the quest, goer with and polar traveler. They have so many climates to explore, many seas to sail, descents and climbs, vigils and expenditures, reports to make of singing wires and balances of well-hung crucibles. That is the thing to praise, for them, companionship, the pleasure of their company, and lighting up of loneliness as each alone is targeting alone. This is a poem by Ed Marshall. Times Square. Against the drugstore, Whalen's, legs spread, my arms akimbo. A few minutes later, have you ever seen a Marine? Do you have a place to stay? Way down, tip of island. Oh, that is too far a subway ride for me to go with you. You are a beautiful creation. Yes, you are. A few weeks later, I met him, telephoning to me again from Dixie Hotel. Did he stay in town again, or did he say, Ma? Another degree, rehearsal, for Demolay. Such a beautiful creation. No cigarettes, no drink, but hot fingers and many kisses. Off at Back Bay to Bickford's, maybe to take a quick look. Too late for a quickie, though. At Route 128, suburbia meets to keep passengers from the city. But no stampede of jackets on the train to take us home to the hayloft. In Roxbury, goodbye, Mansard. I hope you pick up that Victorian stuff flooding the Lower East Side. Keep it in Roxbury. Thank you. Goodbye, new brick development. See you, rubble, in 1960. Bye. It is too didactic. What else? So it teaches. I expect it. Yes, you believe me. Only to screech on or preach, then jump. Mr. NYU said it was didactic, and he got just what was coming to him until he came off, and off he went. All right. And this is the Imperatrice, which John was known to do. He crossed it out, and he edited it. So I'll read a combination of the edited version. The Imperatrice, who sits supreme above all human ecstasy, with a 9-star circle of dominion about her head, and the crown of heaven atop it, who falls not but our smoke as an incense to her eyes, and our axe held in the claws of the falcon on her right hand, scepter and pole, crossed globe at her left, lily growing out of her hip, and half moon crushed to a quarter under bare foot. Lady of the blue robe, scent of sperm, a cloud of devotion to her nostrils, and the pale wind of heaven folded behind her back. Difficult image, hazy to the mind, description inadequate to the infinity inherent in her action of sitting on a throne, with the objects of eternity about her and on display for our eyes worn out with love. Thank you.
Thank you. When Joe asked me to join this company, my mind immediately went to Robin Blazer, and my imagination constantly has him and Spicer flowing into Boston and the flow going back to Berkeley, not San Francisco, Berkeley at this point, and the importance that is, in at least in my imagination. And our library is all packed up, and I went on the internet and immediately found this. This is The Fire, which, if I remember correctly, when Blazer read for word of mouth, this is what he opened with there. So, Robin Blazer. I'm writing here about my poetry in relation to poetry. The writing had an occasion for a few in San Francisco where I read it last March 8th. I want to talk about the personalism and the so-called obscurity of my poems in relation to the sight, sound, and intellect that compose them. The test of poetry, in Zukoski's words, is the range of pleasure it affords as sight, sound, and intellection. One difficulty I want to describe is that I'm haunted by a sense of the invisibility of everything that comes into me, aware that nothing is more invisible than emotion. By emotion, I mean the heat of one's sense of the war, or a place, or a body, or the extensions of these, the earth, the existence of gods, and so forth. The I have seen what I have seen, recorded by Pound in Canto 2. I believe there is a reality which, given the leisure to live for it, is neither conceptual and systematized in the ordinary sense of these words, nor imageless. There are many times when, forced by exhaustion, I take the lazy way of the conceptual and imageless, but it is a kind of desire which leads me to write of that other, outside world. Because the personal stake in companionship becomes so great in the way I live, I am sometimes lost when a reader finds me uninteresting or too obscure, his interest too soon exhausted to come to any meeting. I am literal about that other reality. It is, I think, the purest storytelling to try to catch that light, and the difficulty of it, the loss of it, is personal. If I see the light even fragmentarily and lose it, that too is subject matter and leads to a kind of heartless poem, for it is not the elegiac loss which interests me, but the difficulty, the activity of holding on to it. Burning up myself, I would leave fire behind me. To hold an image within the line by sound and heat is to have caught something that passed out there. The psychological accuracy of this perception is not enough. The sculptural imagistic quality is not enough. And the very aesthetic quality of taking the one image and even three images as a whole, the beauty of the idea that you can write a single poem, is a lie. The processional aspect of the world has to be caught in the language also. The body hears the world, and the power of the earth over the body, the city over the body, is, in terms of rhythms, meters, phrasing, picked up. The body's own rhythms compose those, or it would shake to pieces. The music of the spheres is quite real, but the sound of the earth must meet it. I suppose I want to say that the real business of poetry is cosmology, and I'm claiming my own stake in this, and this is the activity of telling the story, the necessity of chemical. It is not invented, but it is original, personal, singular, and even domestic. If one man gives up his life for the world, the energy of it is not symbolical. It is the story of one man tied to the heaven and hell he recognizes. No symbols. Stan Persky was reading to me one night when a passage turned up that is so much to my own purpose, slightly reworded, that I won't give the author credit. It is in that meeting entirely mine. Quote, what we describe as imagination is no free play of the soul, but a real meeting with real elements that are outside of us. And what matters is not the surrender to the images of fantasy that appear, but to redeem those elements themselves. What we suppose we affect merely in our souls, in reality, we affect on the destiny of the world." End quote. Here, I wish to say that it is not language which is the source. It is the record of the meeting and the magical structure of sight, sound, and intellect. Language is given to us, and in the most insidious way, it controls sight, sound, and intellect. But it is also the medium which can be shaped. Metaphor as a focus is an immediate escape from the ordinary focus, which rots for some reason I can't explain, and keeps me always from using the word we. Though there is a kind of we that I hope to earn the right to use. But the poem offers a field of energy and activity to be met by whatever companion can be found. If you imagine, as I do, that at any waking moment you are a corpuscle in the left wrist of God, then any reality is precisely to be found in the flow of corpuscles in that vast body. In the constant interruption that it is to go to work every day, to talk in generalities of things that can be known as specifics, this time guiding others through American writing, I am struck by this thing called cosmology. Poe wanders off into a long prose piece, Eureka, which he calls a poem, and it is, drawing on all the contemporary science he can digest to record a cosmology. Emerson drops poetry and heads into poetically structured essays where he can describe a cosmology. Thoreau drops poetry to write two strangely structured books where, as in Walden, the detailed attention given to the seasons is cosmological. Melville goes about it backwards in Moby Dick. Myths had to be reset so that they could say what they should say about origins. Where he is, then, later in the poetry, clanks along, unable to hold on to what he wants. Whitman comes in with a new line, as open as he could make it. Henry Adams moves from the well-formed novel to the work on the great virgin of the 13th century to tell in detail the story of a unified world. Pound puts it in the cantos when he says, "The first thing was to break the iambic pentameter." It seems to me that the whole marvelous thing of open form is a traditional and an American problem, hung up on form because it was so difficult to open it. The whole thing came in a geography where the traditional forms would no longer hold our purpose. I was very moved when some years ago I was reading a scholarly book by Jo Miles in which she is making an argument for this sublime poem, which oddly has something to do with the public poem, and she begins to talk about the narrative of the spirit. I think the key word here is narrative, the story of persons, events, activities, images, which tell the tale of the spirit. I am interested in a particular kind of narrative, what Jack Spicer and I agreed to call in our own work the serial poem. This is a narrative which refuses to adopt an imposed storyline and completes itself only in the sequence of poems, if in fact a reader insists upon a definition of completion which is separate from the activity of the poems themselves. The poems tend to act as a sequence of energies which run out when so much of the tale is told. I like to describe this in Ovidian terms as Carmen Perpetuum, a continuous song in which the fragmented subject matter is only apparently disconnected. Ovid's words are, "To tell of bodies transformed into new shapes, you gods whose power worked all transformations, help the poet's breathing. Lead my continuous song from the beginning to the present world."
Thank you.
Yeah. Ryan Gallagher.
Yes.
Black hat.
How's it going? Thanks for having me.
I too have been poring over lots of books and trying to figure out what I wanted to read, which has been really enjoyable. One of the things that has interested me is what makes someone a Boston poet or a Boston writing, and that's been really interesting because I'm enamored by geography. And it's also made me think about lineage in the sense of like who we're pulling from lineage. So I'm going to read some blues poetry from Jack Kerouac. And it also sort of made me appreciate hearing a lot about Williams and Pound. But I think looking back at some of these writers, I think we do ourselves a disservice to not realize what an important poet Langston Hughes was in terms of sort of our American poetics. And also, what an influence I've been hearing about San Francisco's influence on Boston. So this is four poems from San Francisco Blues. 36 chorus. Fallen off in wind. I got the San Francisco blues, bluer than misery. I got the San Francisco blues, bluer than eternity. I gotta go on home, find me another sanity. I got the San Francisco blues, bluer than heaven's gate, mate. I got the San Francisco blues, bluer than blue paint, saint. I better move on home, sleep in my golden dream again. 37th chorus. I got the Santa Kiska blues, singing in the street all day. I got the Santa Kiska blues, wailing in the street all day. I better move on, partner, make my west the eastern way. San Francisco, San Francisco, oh, baby. 38th chorus. Ever seen a tired baby crying itself to sleep in its mother's arms, wailing all night long while the locomotive wails on back, a cry for a cry in the smoke and the lamp of the hot-ass night? Well, that's how I feel. That's how I feel. That's how I feel. What a deal. Yes, I'm going on home. Oh, oh. 39th chorus. Yes, I'm going on home today. Tonight, I'll be riding the 80-mile zipper and flying down the coast wrapped in a blanket, crying and cold. So, brother, pour me a drink. I got lots of friends from coast to coast, ocean to ocean, girls. But when I see a bottle of wine and see that it's full, I like to open it and drink of it my fill. The other piece that I'm going to read from Kerouac is the first section. I'm not going to read, I'm going to recite it. But it's the first section from Old Age of Midnight. And recently, this was new to me, maybe it's not new to anyone else. I saw that he sort of had ripped a line off from Gertrude Stein's The World is Round, from about the same section in the book right at the beginning. So again, I think we do ourselves a disservice when we're not reading all of these writers through Gertrude Stein as well. First section of Old Angel Midnight. Friday afternoon in the universe. In all directions, in and out, you got your men, women, dogs, children, horses, pones, ticks, perts, pots, pans, pools, palls, pails, potorances, and petty thieveries that turn into heavenly Buddha. I know, boy, what's I talking about? In case I made the world, and when I made it, I know lies, and had Old Angel Midnight for my name, and concocted up a world so nothing you had forever thereafter make believe it's real. Well, that's all right, because now everything will be all right, and we'll soothe the forever boys and girls, and before we're through, we'll find a name for this goddamn golden eternity and tell a story too. And bud, you ever read a story as vast as this that starts Friday afternoon with workmen on scaffolds painting white paint and ants murling in their little black dens and microbes worn in your kidneys and Messeruli's microbin in the innards of mercury and microbes dreaming of the ultimate microbehood, which then ultimates outward to the endless, vast, empty atom, which is this imaginary universe. Ending nowhere, never e been born, as Bonk A. Well pulled when he ferried his mother over the rocks to Twa E. T. And people visit his hut to inquire, what other planet features this? And he answers, what other planet? though the sounds of the entire world go swimming through this window. For Miss McCarthy, oldest Twando, in old Polk's home, drunk again, and of course you hear the cats wailing in the whale bar, wild bar, wart fence, moonlight, midnight, angel, dolophine, immensity, visions of the Tathagata's seat of purity and womb. And so that here is all this, infinite, immaterial metal like golden ash, swim swarming in our enlightened brains, in the silence, sheafalian and endless ears. And still, we refuse, naked and blank, to hear what the who, to what you will say. The diamond boat and persipine, recipine, mill town, heroine and fact matches, the silver ages everlasting, schwalm schwalian and the simple broom. And at night, you raise a square white light from your ghost beneath a root-drinking tree. And coyote won't hear you, but you ward off the inexistency devils just to pass the time away. And meanwhile, it's timeless to the ends of the last light year. It might as well be getting late, Friday afternoon, where we start, so his old son can come home when works are done and drink his beer and tweak his children's eyes. Thank you.
Frank O'Hara, of course, is usually most closely associated with New York City, but he has had a significant history in the Boston area. He, what I learned more recently was that he studied piano at Berklee College for a couple of years. I think it was probably before he was drafted. And then, of course, went to Harvard later and participated in the Poets Theater in Cambridge and so on. And apart from that, you know, knew many of the poets of his generation from all over. So I tried to choose a few poems that have at least some Boston reference in them. This one is called V.R. Lang, which of course is Bunny Lang, who is an important figure in the Poets Theater in Cambridge in the 50s. V.R. Lang, you are so serious as if a glacier spoke in your ear, or you had to walk through the great gate of Kiev to get to the living room. I worry about this because I love you. And if it weren't grotesque enough that we live in hydrogen and breathe like atomizers, you have to think I'm a great architect. And you float regally by on your incessant escalator, calm, a jungle queen, thinking it a steam shovel, looking a little uneasy. But you are yourself again, yanking silver beads off your neck. Remember, the Russian Easter Overture is full of bunnies. The always high, full of regard and honor and lanolin. Oh, ride horseback in pink linen. Be happy and with your beads on because it rains. Where's that other thing? I knew I would lose myself somewhere. Oh yeah, here it is. A walk on Sunday afternoon. The gulls wheeled several miles away and the bridge, which stood on wet bark trees, was broad and cold. Rio de Janeiro is just another fishing village, said George. The sun boomed calmly in the wind around the monument. Texans and Australians climbed to the top to look at Beacon Hill and the Common. Later, we walked around the base of the hill to the Navy Yard, and the black and white twigs stuck in the sky above the old hull. Outside the gate, some children jumped higher and higher off the highway embankment. Cars honked, leaves on trees shook, and above us the elevated trolley trundled along. The wind waved steadily from the sea. Today we have seen Bunker Hill and the Constitution, said George. Tomorrow, probably, our country will declare war. This is a sonnet called Boston. These heavy wings lurch in a gummy sky on either side of me, and it has been too shiny all the way, the blinding grin of clouds, the altitude's deafening sigh. This time I can pick out the buildings my friends laugh and sulk interestingly in. With tears of relief I come roaring, thin and stinging lonely in the earth's flat eye. Beside the dumpy airport rotting soon, a once romantic colonial port, the city guards. They run fast on fences towards me. Another hour and my senses would have plunged like Icarus's foot between sun and sea, yet now on land find close consort. This I wanted to read because just strictly to embarrass myself, because a large part of it is in French. And it's also refers to Bunny Lang. It's actually part six of his long poem, Second Avenue. So I hope you laugh at my French pronunciation heartily. Nous avons eu lundi soir le grand plaisir de rencontrer à l'hôtel Olofsson, où elle est descendue, la charmante Mademoiselle Anne R. Lang, actrice du Théâtre Dramatique de Cambridge. Miss Lang est arrivée à Port-au-Prince le mardi 24 février à bord d'un avion de la Resort Airline. Cette belle artiste a visité les sites de la capitale et était enchantée de tout ce qu'elle a vu. Elle est fort épise de notre pays. And it's very exciting to be an old friend of Verlaine, and he has his problems, divine dustbag pressure chambers, which is merely an episode clarifying what the work really is in relationship with birds and insects you are sitting on as you drink and think about dancing. Poor, dedicated blonde that you are, ma fille, ma soeur, my fellow airlines provocateur and sandal dropper on the huts. Do you know which back alley we would park and snot the wimple in? It is embarrassing to be too rich with black looks. He would be waiting for you to come in from roaming, slipper in left hand raised, the famous left hand of the epigraph. Ah, oui, tumbling vipers where you stain, where you're staying. Excuse, tumbling vipers where you're staying, lar, hot tranced, into the hydrogen of a backache, which is a whole harem of swaying odors and caravansary grit. Alors, Saint Mung, the middling passionate rapids down where a tender word rushes to snarl and laugh deliriously into the back of the head where the hair barnacles its uneasy lay against the nape, so ecstatic, like church bells against the flanks of horsetails. Sleight of hand, O Ren Überschreigung of an old lavatory. It was that way many times, yet the winter seemed prompt. Well, two more. I'll go backwards a little bit. Sudden snow. While a company of dancers hoots, whistles, stomps, carries on in front of a palatial TV set with crystalline cobalt goblets surmounting it about Rita Hayworth, Betty Davis, Jack Cole, Busby Berkeley, Mark Platt, snow is falling on the sidewalk, and two girls arrive who'd fallen on their asses in the street ice, crossing first. It is the first sign of reality at night. Snow avenues are made for crossing. The fur bearers often do slip, just as your cheeks have a little darker down on the cheekbones under lashes, and the more tired, the more cheerful, so long as among friends quips, tenderness, and interest continues to falter, not brazen like a Pompadour bomb 40s. There's a window giving on the bedroom. In it, a tall, dark figure sits like Aston Nielsen in Hamlet. A girl lies on a pink pillow on the floor, giggling about an equity meeting. All of us understand why Lucille Ball is such a success. For a moment, I realize how happy I am to be beside you on the floor, and my heart nearly bursts. So to avoid embarrassment, I make a vile remark about sweet Janet Blair. And you look kind of cross. No, you are proud of my mean tongue. And the snow, like Charles Olson working on one of his ABC poems, is quietly and bitterly falling. But we don't know that yet. You drink more tea. Your arm feels a little bit thinner. This morning, two ladies from Jehovah's Witnesses came to call on me in my dungarees, explaining their 3,750,000 copies printed in Sinyanja, Shoshona, English, Locano, Tagalog, and Twi, Marathi, Pangasinian, Papiamento, Solosi, Xhosa, Zulu, and Finnish. So all day I think of the terrible limitations of poetic style as we know it. till you take me to the movies, which reach everywhere, and remind me that you understand me better than I understand you. And I am happy. Yes, it's time to go. Love is like the path in snow we are making, though no one else can follow, leading us only to the ocean shore embrace of summer, serious and free, as you tell me you've got to have eggs for breakfast, and we divert our course a little without fear. And finally, to John Wieners. You walk into a theater in the semi-dark, a tiny stage holding up a candle. A few actors are pacing from shadow to shadow, mouthing some misty, emblematic rhetoric about incest and garden that has telescopes. But you hear something and look. A stout lady in furs is pouting over script, and the director is fondling his braces, purple. The prop man is commiserating with a girlfriend on the telephone, and a character actor is explaining the ticket tax to a voluptuary usherette who's bleached. The producer has his feet up on the row in front. It's none of these, is it? Ticking away, the lead is patting her hair and picking her teeth, and a pale young man in a muffler sits erect in the last row. Whose heart is beating in the shell? The pulse of poetry, although the sound girls at a funeral. And one day, weeks later, the muffler, gray and old for one so young, unwraps his sheaf of poems, heard already among the sets under the work light. A voice is heard, though everyone was mumbling, now so silent that the dark is all blown up. She has exposed her bosom in its late disguise under a muffler. It could be St. Petersburg or Cambridge, and the snow and theater, like Philip Sparrow, nestle there. Thanks.
I have put into my hair rosemary because the Greeks did that for examinations. I want to start with my teacher. Robert Lowell was my teacher, and I have a line of his that I like. This is from Lord Wearys Castle. The scythers, time and death, helmed locusts, move upon the tree of wrath. And that's from Where the Rainbow Ends. The next person you all know. This is from Joe Torres' Lift double issue, Paul Petricone's extraordinary photo. And tell me if you know, excuse me, Garrett, but if you know, what is the origin or influence of this poem by Steve? P.M. Walk with a light foot, you above ground. Know slowly that I once bestrode like a colossus, up and down the beckoning turn, and in my day did grasp the light, and did him wrestle, till the bell tolled the final round. God. Okay. Now I go to Jack Powers. Where is he?
He's on the back of this one.
Here. Okay, this is Jack Powers. My photo. I'm really proud of it. It was his office, okay? And Jack influenced my life. I mean, many lives. In fact, when he was 7 years old, he, well, anyway,
there you go.
He On his 7th birthday, he burst into tears because he had only 93 years to do all that he had to do. His poem, This Fire, is from the Uncertainty of the Creator. What is it? The Uncertainty of... Well, anyway. This fire. Jack. No one wants the heat of this fire. No one wants to burn alive. But that's where I thrive, at the absolute of ever, never hearing never, always feeling what's alive. Jack Powers, 2000. Four. Okay. This extraordinary photo, I thought I took myself and I was so happy. But to my horror, it wasn't me. It was Lisa Leyland. And it was Linda Crane's opera, Spring. Ay, excuse me. Oh, this was 197 at Staples, and I'm telling you, Staples is unbelievable. This line is from Seabirds by Linda Parker. Linda. Knowing you have to cross, and perhaps this water will be heaven before any of us is home. Oh, okay. Garrett, well, I have this on my wall, so I read it every day, okay? And I'm very devoted to it, but I left the line at home, and so this is the best we can do. It's from his poem to Steve Jonas. The gods of this world tread on grapes.
Brains.
Okay, this is very important. Let's start again. To Steve Jonas, the gods of this world tread on brains like grapes. What can we do in the wine press but sing? Okay, this is my friend, Willie Coakley, was born in Brighton, Mass. Went to Harvard and hates Boston, and so we don't see him very much. And this is New American Review, number 1, and I made him send it to me, because I'm a little devoted to it. It's to his friend, Robin. Invasion of the animals. My body's animals are cold without. Admit them to your house. The gentle beasts of lip or tongue nibble until you let them in. The lions of my hair, my owl eyes surprise you at your windows. Alas, my nose, giraffe, ungainly brute, can only nudge the roof. And reptiles of my limbs constrict to tamper with your posts. But at your door, the horses of my hip grow riotous, open up. Oh, let the smooth gazelle of thigh invade your privacy. And mandrill proud, my great and central beast, insists to its entrance with the rest. Till every ant of skin and nerve enjoy the crevices of your love. My animals of body, swell your rooms and rummage in your goods and take possession of the house. Never let them loose. William Leo Coakley. my husband, John. We have researched together for 47 years, and we've been married 43, almost. The cosmology of the ancients. A lot of camping out in the snow, etc. Philosophy begins in wonder, and at the end, when philosophic thought has done its best, the wonder remains, and that's Alfred North Whitehead. The cosmology of the ancients, Anasazi. Earth, sky, underworld. We do not live below the sky. We do not see the stars. We do not know the solar and lunar standstills. We do not live in rhythmic, cyclic time. Imprisoned by the mechanical clock, we do not know the cosmos in which we dwell. In the hour before dawn, the coyotes appeared, unseen, but announcing their presence with a few barks, then more, the howling chorus began, growing loud and coming toward us. We two humans, exposed in open air, flat on the ground in our winter sleeping bags, presenting ourselves to the cosmos, to the stars, to the marauding coyotes. It's their territory. We have been here other years without this encounter. Why do they appear now? With their barks and howls coming close, what do they speak into our ears? The voice of the cosmos, what does it say to us? John Gallery.
First, I'm going to read, since so much seems to be about Stephen Jonas, I'm going to read a poem of his from Impressions for John Wieners, simply called Gloucester, and this was written actually shortly before I actually met Steve, so it goes back to the 60s. Gloucester, this section. As to a trumpet blast reawakened, I return to places once visited. Old names, streets, and familiar sights revive of the instant. Thus are we judged by former knowledge, arising now, fresh bloomed, from beneath the past tense of the subjective cemetery. Riding, riding, still riding back the subjective omnibus. Returning from Manchester when Mrs. Butler was alive, God rest her, with Richard, my old da, and et cetera, to Oak Street, Gloucester. A fine old house as his grandfather left it. Clabbered, Queen Anne, Federalist, door brass as the eagles spread, colonial ladder backs, the floor 8 or more inches wide, the boards were. Several generations on the land, and with horror of horrors concealed in every closet. His mother, a fit of starts and stops, and was shocked that I wanted to go over to East Gloucester's Jazzed Storyville, move to North Shore of the summer, but my Dickie suggested instead we go up to see how Our Lady was doing. Our Lady, to cue you, was signaled to get the old man's car keys and hightail it over to Rockport, where the ritual of the highly mystical quarry of Los Abandonados, and on weekend, nearly half of Harvard's Divinity School. And it is said that Rockport's a dry town. There were other moments, too, as when the blessing of the fleet and she goes down to the sea, rose and anemone petals trail out to sunset, red in the afterglow. There was a studio in Pigeon Cove where Eleanor, divine name, declaimed me the four quartets. I was brought to my knees, and so it was that I decided for poetry. Also, there was the matter of the old Salzburger, old salt in Gloucester Harbor, and the burgomaster we need not go into. But the cruise about the harbor of a Sunday and the summer houses nestled in the cliffs of Annisquam stay with me. There was more, much more, though mostly Samuse à Samuse. Memory, she is also mother of the muse. So that the judgment that might be finality is no more than her flowers reawakened to delect us. My friend, shall we partake further of that mortal odor? Now I'd like to read a poem of my own, dedicated to Willie Alexander, called Blown in Boston. No snow, frisson, steal away his fancy from jumping in the crater hot. Bam, bam, thank you, ma'am, without benefit of bennies, or frenzied clergyman to claw the air, and clock knock knocking at some timeless gate. What's that, the rat emerging from a runny nose as too much tinkle spins? A go is gone without a lass. Now near the Isles of Greece, those voices in the wind, voracious, sing, Great Pan's not dead. And I'll close with another poem from Stephen Jonas, which is reprinted in Let the Bucket Down, called A Revel. And it reminds me of spring coming on. You know, we're halfway through. A Revel for John Fusco. Delirious as though of Barbato's I had drunk, and a strange passion swelling blood into my heart, from my mind runs the poem upon dithyrambic feet. Lustily I cry out in a poem to you, my sweet will be 20 on Sunday next. Upon such feet of shaggy measure I come privily, permitting, it pleases you, a scene by Fragonard prostrate to whisper to you beneath a hedge, as above and about hover nymphs, naiads, and other demi-beasts of sorts, even to the hushed wings of pretty doves fluttering and cherubs caroling, my amours, repeat, my sweet will be 20 on Sunday next. Now in middle March, when the wind is intemperate still, I muster what devices the imagination prompts me to. A painter, those conceits are not unfamiliar to you, so I need not make apologies for the decor, classic and eclectic, which in my frenzy I arranged, hoping therewith to ensnare your fancy, sweet. It is a poet's madness driving him willy-nilly, howbeit to his own destruction, masked or metamorphosed into some wondrous animal guise, centaur, unicorn, or fawn. Repeat, my sweet will be 20 on Sunday next. So even to the birds whose calls the ancients invoked and cooed unabashedly their canzones to wit a woo, all of it I bring again, my sweet, to you in the springtime of the poem. Where else, when spray begins to springeth, could I come in my folly, bearing you in some small measure, such snatches purloined as I have of that antique liturgy, repeat, my sweet will be 20 on Sunday next. The phrase as reprieve reverberates within my skull, as if in my high passion, may he not also love me too. Thank you.